for the marvelous introduction. Since this is mostly a physics crowd, what I thought I would do is dispense with the jargon to start out. So we astronomers use strange units like kiloparsec, ergs, KeV, and so on. So I just want to sort of set this up. Kiloparsec, I'll throw around quite a bit. It's obviously 1,000 parsecs, which is 3 × 10^21 centimeters. It's 3.26 light years. And basically, to put sort of things on a scale that will be comparable to what I'll be showing, at least on the small end, 100,000 light years is about 30 kiloparsecs, and that's about the visual size of the Milky Way. The kind of energies that I'll be talking about are quite large, sort of 10^62 ergs, and I just want to sort of set that into perspective. A supernova explosion, or a gamma ray burst, which is often cited as the most powerful explosion in explosions in the universe, liberate about 10^53 ergs, but only about 10^51 are available to do work on a large scale. So effectively, 10^51 is the amount of workable energy that you get out of a supernova if you ignore the explosion itself. I'll also refer to temperature in KeV units. And so several KeV will be the characteristic temperatures of the objects I'll be looking at. And one KeV is about 10^7 degrees Kelvin. And of course, the pressures, when I say high pressure, I'll be referring to pressures that are almost as good as the vacuums that you get across the street in our labs at Waterloo. But the timescales we're working on here are sort of hundreds of millions to billions of years. And so even a pressure like this can actually do quite a bit on these scales. So if I slip into jargon, please don't hesitate to stop me. OK, so since this is a theoretical crowd, probably the most theoretical crowd I've ever spoken to, I'll start out with a theorist view of the universe. So this is an image taken from a very large simulation of cold dark matter. And what it shows is this web, this cosmic structure, web of cosmic structure, which is seen here. This is all dark matter. And basically, the color intensity here is proportional to density. And what you can see in these, this is the late time snapshot of what the universe looks like in mass, in dark matter. And you can see that at the centers of these webs, at these nodes, there are these very massive objects in here. These are galaxy clusters. And so this is the way they would look in a theorist's universe. The way they look in my universe is something closer to this. And so what I can do is with this slide, I'll spend a little bit of time and I'll summarize the entire talk on this slide, and then I'll spend the rest of the time explaining it in more detail. So what have I shown here? This is a galaxy cluster called MSO735 and so on. It's what's shown here in white, okay, are galaxies, so the name galaxy clusters. But keep in mind that galaxy clusters is a bit of an historical misnomer. By far, the largest mass constituency in this image is the dark matter, which you don't see. It's the glue that holds everything together. And the other interesting thing here, so these are the galaxies. All of these galaxies that you see are sitting in this cluster. You'll notice that there's a very large galaxy at the center. It's known as a central cluster galaxy. I'm assuming that you're going to have to take that. But that may be wrong, because we have not detected a dark matter particle. Also talk about black holes. And I'll say that we don't know that black holes exist either, although Rob took me to task on this last week. So you can't say anything at perimeter without, even if you think you're being reasonable. So I'll try to be as reasonable as I can. And so these are all galaxies sitting in this potential. And the blue in here, this haze, is very hot gas that's at a temperature of about 6 kilovolts or 6 keV. And that gas is at the virial temperature, or the characteristic gravitational temperature, of this big dark matter halo. And in fact, all of the baryons, most of the baryons by far, are in this very hot phase. They're actually not in galaxies and stars. And this is actually a problem, and has been a problem for a long time. And maybe the solution is at hand. It's not clear. It's also true that the gas is a little hotter than you would expect from just standard lambda cold dark matter scenarios. It's got a little more heat than you'd expect just from gravity alone. And I'll argue that it's possible that this heat may be the detritus, the junk that flew out of black holes that we think exists in every one of the galaxies that are shown here. In addition to that, you'll see this red stuff here. This is synchrotron radiation, okay? And its origin goes right down to the center of this big giant galaxy, which I'll argue has probably a 5 × 10⁹ solar mass black hole in it, and I'll present evidence by the end that it may have a black hole that's 10 times larger than that. And in fact, this is what I'm hoping by the next Hubble telescope round, I'll have an answer to that question. There may be a very large black hole there, but all of this energy that's pouring out of the galaxy seems to be coming from a small region at the center where we think exists a very large black hole. And this light here, synchrotron light, it looks pretty prominent here, but it's actually faint. And the other thing, and it's funny when people come through and give talks, they always want to show something strange, right? So I'm at perimeter, I need to do something, you know, sort of weird, and so I'll follow a note. This is as weird as it gets for me, okay? And so what's going on here, this looks like a normal galaxy cluster, but in fact it's the largest explosion or outburst that we know of in the universe. Okay, and how do we know that? Well, you wouldn't know it if you didn't have X-ray eyes, okay? So in the radio, which is what we typically use to trace the output of a black hole, it's actually pretty nondescript, okay? It's about 10 to the 41 to 10 to the 42 ergs per second, which is hardly sort of quasar level. Quasar levels tend to be 10 to the 45, 10 to the 46 or so, so you never would have picked it out. But the way we know that this is a powerful object is that if you can barely see it here, I'll show you on the next slide a really nice image of it, but there are these huge holes here. So the size scale is also of interest. From here to here, or say from tip to tip here, that's about 600 kiloparsecs. So this is a big area, okay? And there's a big hole in this blue haze that was punched out of this cluster by these jets. And each one of those holes is about 200 kiloparsecs across. So you could stuff 600 Milky Ways in there. And the amount of mass that was displaced is about a trillion solar masses. And it turns out the energy required to do that is 10 to the 62 ergs. Okay, and to put that in perspective, that's a few percent of the rest mass energy of a billion solar mass black hole. And it all happened 100 million years ago, we got started. I'll get to that. It's actually, it turns out given the physics that goes on here, it's actually trivial. It's just PD work, okay? So I'll just give you the upshot. We measure the temperature and density of the gas. We do that very accurately. You do something as simple as put an aperture down on it, and even a crude measurement will do. It took me about 5 minutes when I first got I knew right away it was big. It's just the PV work, essentially. There's also a shock front that you don't see very well that goes around that, that gives us an independent measure of the energy as well, and they agree to within about a factor of two. And that also, we are measuring the pressure. I'll explain it, yeah. Yes, we're measuring an average integrated pressure over this time. So I'll explain what the logic is. Yeah.
Is the density that I'm seeing here of white blobs pretty much the actual density of galaxies, or are there hidden galaxies that I can't see?
Oh, there are many fainter. This is a Hubble image of it, and there are many, many fainter galaxies below that.
So how many galaxies are in this cluster?
There's thousands of galaxies.
Thousands?
Yeah.
And how does the density in the cluster compare to the density in some random region of space?
It's much higher. So the density in here is sort of, the density at the center, well, let me get to that. So the gas density at the center here is about 10 to the minus 2 particles per square centimeter, which is
much, much higher than sort of outer. So
orders of magnitude larger.
Because I'm trying to get an idea what a galaxy cluster is, how dense it is.
So a galaxy cluster, in terms of the average density of stars, the stars are clumped into galaxies, okay? There are intercluster stars, but by and large, they're clumped into galaxies, something like our own Milky Way, something like a nearby elliptical galaxy. And the vast majority, the vast volume of this thing is empty of stars, largely. So it's these S particles flying around that have a very small fraction of the mass that are sitting in this dark matter halo, which dominates the mass, and the whole halo is filled with very hot gas. This is the temperature of gas. It's hot because that's the temperature required to keep this in balance.
Sorry, my question is just
it's about a thousand times.
Thank you.
Oh, you want to know O. Okay.
Sorry.
I guess I misinterpreted.
Okay, so...
So the average distance between galaxies is about 10 times...
10 times the...
inside the cluster than it is in the universe.
Perfect. Thanks.
Sorry. Thank you.
Sorry.
Ryan.
Yes.
I guess.
So all those galaxies, the white ones that I see, are all at about Z's 0.2.
Yeah.
Can I use slight differences, or not me, but you, or people use slight differences in the redshift to estimate how deep this thing is?
You could in principle, but the thing is the actual the velocity dispersion is what's going to dominate here. So you're going to have a very hard time getting depth for something like this.
So do we have any concept of how, like, is this squished and flat? Is it a big blob? Do we have any idea?
You know, it, on the large scales, if you look at the X-ray emission, it's fairly regular, which suggests it's probably slightly elliptical, but it doesn't seem to be particularly flat or super round. I mean, it's more or less
probably roughly as deep as we see it.
That would be the assumption, right? Yeah. So, so it's the, you know, the site of what of the biggest explosion that we know of in the universe. But what's kind of weird about this? Well, one of the things that's weird, as I already mentioned, is even though this is extraordinarily powerful, the level of synchrotron radiation is not very powerful. So somehow it's putting out all of this power, but it's all mechanical. It's not radiating. The other thing that's kind of interesting here is all of these galaxies are red. Okay, not one of them is blue. It's not forming any stars or very few stars. And this has been a problem for some time because in our, you know, the Lambda CDM model, it's a universe that grows hierarchically. And the idea is that the biggest things should in principle have the youngest systems. They would have just absorbed the youngest systems. Yet these galaxies are very old. Okay, there's no evidence or very little evidence that gas is cooling out and accreting onto them. And this was explained a long time ago by Martin Rees and others as the reason they argue that they're not forming stars is that the gas that's sitting in them is at the virial temperature of the galaxy, and so its cooling time is very long. But when you look at the cooling time in this galaxy, at the center near this, yep, your cooling time went up, right down near the center of the galaxy, it's only a few 10 to the 8 years. So in principle, this gas should be cooling out and forming stars like gangbusters in this thing. In fact, it should be forming stars at a rate of hundreds of solar masses per year, which rivals the rates that we see in nascent galaxies in the distant universe. They're not doing that. That explanation by Rees et al. Is wrong. Okay, so the cooling time is very short. And so the answer must be that the gas has to be heated up. And what I'll show today is that, indeed, that seems to be the case. What we see quantitatively in these systems is the gas is being heated up. And it's being heated up to just the right amount. Yes?
All ellipticals,
then? These are all ellipticals that you see.
So there's no spirals in the
clusters? There are some spirals in the clusters, but they're not very obvious in the simulation
systems. But the puzzling thing for me is that these holes have not been used out. So does that mean they were formed quite recently?
Yes. 10 or 8 years ago, so I'll get into that a little bit too. So that's strange. Now the other thing, the final thing that's weird about this is if you want to, the standard mode of creating such a large outburst is through the accretion of gas. Okay, and so you can work your way back, if you have 10 to the 62 ergs of energy, you can work your way back to how much mass would have had to accrete down onto the black hole in order to generate this using sort of standard assumptions about the conversion between mass and energy in these situations, which is generally 10% of the rest mass energy. And you can work that your way back, and it turns out that the mass that was required to be gobbled up by the black hole to create that is about 6 × 10⁸ solar masses of gas. Okay? but when you... Yes?
Is that true even if the energy comes from the spin of the black hole?
I'm getting
the
right.
Okay. You're killing me here.
Okay. So
I think the whole talk will be this slide.
It's you know, well, that was the point. So you can leave after the slide. The rest is details, okay? Okay. But so the logical thing to do is to go out and get CO measurements of the molecular gas content, and people have done that, and it turns out there's an upper limit that's about 2 × 10⁹.
So there's less than 2 × 10⁻⁹ solar masses of gas in this system. It took 6 × 10⁸ solar masses to power it. So it means, let's just assume that all of that gas is there just under the limit. It means that all of the gas in this galaxy had to stop doing what it was doing. And it had to make a beeline for this little thing at the center that's got a Schwarzschild radius of 10 to the 14th centimeters and fall into the black hole. And it had to shed its angular momentum and do this and not form a star. I don't know how nature would do that. Turns out there's a couple of other systems that have figured it out. And so what I'll argue here is maybe, as David said, the energy isn't coming from accretion, it's coming from spin. But even if you want to do that, it turns out, and I won't get into this in any detail, if you look at the best, the typical method is that people invoke to extract power from a black hole by spin. A spinning black hole is known as the Blanford-Zaniac mechanism. And basically, you know, if you want to take something that's rotating and you want to get energy out, you need to put a torque on it, you need to put brake pads on it. And the brake pads are magnetic fields associated with disks. And it turns out that our current models for getting this kind of energy out, you require a spin parameter that's very close to unity if it has a typical black hole there. And you also need a high accretion rate. You can't just tap the spin, okay? You have to basically create the brake pads, which means in current models, you almost need as high an accretion rate to tap the spin as you would get just from the binding energy released from the gas falling in. And I'm going to argue that that's a problem and that maybe we don't understand how to tap spin. That essentially you need to get, to put it in the theorist terms, you need to get energy out that's greater than mc squared in order to make this happen. And I think there are some other systems that show this. So this is, in a funny way, it's sort of a normal system. I have HST data of the nucleus. The nucleus has no star formation. All this gas would have had to fall in. It's got a few dust lanes. The only thing that's weird about it, and I'll show later, is it's got an enormous core. And cores are thought to be due to post-processing. That is, galaxies don't form with cores because they're dissipational system. That is, their densities, the stellar density should be very high at the center. Well, this has a low central stellar density. And one way to do that is to merge very big black holes and toss the stars out. And so I'll argue that this guy may have also the biggest black hole that we know of in the universe, and it may approach sort of 5 × 10⁻¹ solar masses. And I'm hoping that by next year I'll have a measurement from HST to either prove it right or prove it wrong. So this is a very interesting system. This is sort of the whole talk in a nutshell. Basically, what I'm going to argue is the reason why these galaxies are red and stay red and don't grow to much bigger sizes is because their black holes are regulating the amount of energy or the amount of they're preventing gas from cooling. And I'm going to argue that it's probably occurring in a self-regulated way. There's another mystery, and that is that we have evidence for black holes in these systems, in many systems, and the mass of the black hole seems to correlate with the bulge mass of the galaxy. And that comes at a constant ratio. It's 1,000 to 1 or thereabouts. And that indicates that there's some very fine tuning between galaxy formation and the formation of black holes. And it also tells you about what the efficiency of accretion has to be. So in this system, the efficiency of accretion has to be of order unity, because it had to have sucked in all of the gas. But nature tells us that over time, the black hole gets 1 unit of mass for every 1,000 units of mass that form stars. And that's not happening in this system. Yes?
Is it possible that this is a rare event where two very big black holes merge and that's where the energy came from?
It could, but, well, there are people here that know better than I. My issue, it could be that. The problem is, where do you get...
It still has to be a very big black hole, two very big black holes, and where do you get two very big black holes this time of... But these are already... This is already sort of the granddaddy of galaxies. Okay, so we need to get these things boosted up by maybe a factor of 10.
Sure, it has to be a very big black hole.
I'll get to it.
A big core, but I'll never get to it, actually. So anyway, this is more of an advertisement. I said that this is a 500. That was a 40 kilosecond X-ray image. We just got this from the Chandra Observatory. This is a long project. This shows a 500 kilosecond image of the same system. And what I just wanted to show is it's got this beautiful shock front around the center. This allows us to measure the energy superbly and the age to a very fine on a very fine scale. This is one arc minute here. The angular resolution that we get is under it's about an arc second. So pretty good. So I'll run through this. I've said all this. So the best evidence, so I mentioned black holes. The best evidence that black holes exist are in this galaxy M87, which is nearby in the Virgo cluster, and its mass of several 10 to the 9 solar masses was measured using dynamically, using gas in rotation around the nucleus. And of course, the very best and really exquisite evidence for a supermassive black hole, or a massive black hole, is in our own galaxy, where the accelerations of individual stars have actually been measured. And they've shown that they accelerate dramatically around a spot where nothing is. Okay, if we had an image, it's marvelous. Okay, so the things that are zipping around here about a solar mass, they're zipping around an object that's about several 10 to the 6 solar masses, and there's nothing there. Okay, and so that's the best evidence we have that supermassive black holes exist. So you'll have to indulge me for the rest of the time, because that's what I'm going to assume. Again, this is the relationship that I measured. That those sorts of measurements have been done more crudely on about 36 galaxies, and there's a relationship between the mass of the bulge of the galaxy and the black hole mass. And since I'll be focusing on the most massive galaxies in the universe, they all should have black holes of order 10 to the 9 solar masses.
You see those rotation curves. How close to the Schwarzschild radius are you? Is it
you're much further.
None of them are very close to the Schwarzschild radius. So basically, you're within the radius of influence, which, you know, is it's the ratio of c squared to the velocity dispersion squared, which is, you know, factors of thousands.
I don't see anything, not because you close
the track. The argument for the black hole is that dynamically you see a cusp, okay, and the mass to light ratio is dramatically increasing, so the mass density is dramatically increasing. Then you have to appeal to higher beings. Then you argue that basically if you put any normal object in that we know of, they would eventually sink down and they'd end up as a black hole. But we don't have a measurement of an event horizon, which is really the key. That may happen in the next 5 years.
So,
previous slide, it looked like in the pictures on that slide, the disk was not growing with the bulge.
Oh.
Or that's just a cartoon.
Yeah, it is a cartoon. And the issue of where the disk comes in is unsolved, and so I don't even want to go there. So it's kind of messy. So this is sort of the
summary of what I've said. I'm already halfway through. I'll get about halfway through, and then I'll just quit. But basically, this is the fossil evidence that black holes exist, and the consequences of them for galaxy formation are that, you know, I'll argue that these galaxies probably grow in a thermostatically controlled way, and they explain several problems that have been dogging galaxy formation now for decades, one which is called the broken hierarchy of galaxy formations. That is, galaxies seem to be anti-hierarchical, and another way of saying that is, you know, the Lambda CDM model, which works brilliantly at predicting the largest scale structure in the universe, fails miserably to predict the properties of galaxies, and it's a problem. We've been able to show that much of this came about because of the work we've done in X-ray clusters, which is where we can make very good measurements. Okay, we can measure the rate of cooling of the gas, we can measure the power output, we can measure the rates of star formation, so we can actually put this on a very serious an empirical basis. And also the excess number of baryons. One unsolved problem is that there are too many baryons in the universe. There are too many hot baryons. They should be locked up in galaxies, and they're not, and also clusters are quite hot. So this is where I'm going, half an hour in. I'll talk about cooling gas and the problem of galaxy formation. I'll talk about how X-rays can be used to gauge the total power output of accreting black holes. And one of the other problems that's been lingering around for well over half a century is extragalactic radio jets and what they're made of. And I think we're learning a lot about that. And then I'll summarize. And these are my various collaborators, ex-students, continuing colleagues, and my current postdoc, Ken Cavagnolo, and graduate student Cliff Kirkpatrick. I'll show some of their stuff if there's time. So what is the problem? The basic problem in the centers of galaxy clusters is that the cooling time is very short for the gas. It should be cooling out and forming stars at a very high rate, and it's not, as I mentioned before. This is a picture, a different three-dimensional picture of an X-ray image turned on its side, of a galaxy cluster. So at the base here, this is about 100 kiloparsecs across. And what you see at the center of the galaxy cluster is that the X-rays are coming out at a very high rate. So this cusp means that the density, this is thermal bremsstrahlung radiation, so the emissivity scales with the square of the density. So this is very high density gas that's radiating away its energy at a very high rate. That means the gas should cool on a time scale that's short compared to the age of the universe and form stars. This is the prescription for galaxy formation. And what you see here is an image of the Perseus cluster, a fairly nearby cluster. There is evidence that the gas is cooling. There are these fine filaments of H-alpha emission. The galaxy at the center is forming stars at about 20 or 30 solar masses per year. By comparison, our own Milky Way forms stars at 1 or 2 or 3 solar masses per year, and it's considered a burgeoning galaxy. So these things are forming stars, but they're not forming at rates of thousands of solar masses per year, which is what you'd expect due to the, if you just integrate the mass underneath this and divide by its cooling time, you get 1,000 solar masses per year. We don't see that. And before we got these great X-ray images, we also knew that the radio synchrotron power coming throughout, which I described before, is vastly less than what you'd expect you needed to add in or offset those radiative losses. And what we find, which I'll show in a little while, is that these things are mechanically dominated. The synchrotron radiation is just the tip of the iceberg. It's just showing where the energy is coming out. The vast bulk of it is coming out in mechanical energy and not in photons. So how did we do this? Around 2000, two great instruments flew. One is the XMM Newton telescope, which is essentially a light bucket. It's got lousy spatial resolution, but it's a good spectrometer. The Chandra telescope, which I worked on, which has exquisite imaging, but it doesn't have quite the collecting area. And two things were found. Number one, if this gas was actually cooling out at the rates that were predicted just by dividing the mass by the cooling time, as the gas got cooler than a couple of keV, most of the energy should be coming out in lines. This gas in the clusters is enhanced in metals, and so most of the energy should be coming out in recombination radiation, and the bottom line is it isn't. So there's all this energy coming out. It's very bright, but it's not cooling down to low temperatures, or at least not much of it is. So that implies that something is keeping the gas hot. And what we found at about the same time, actually we beat them to the punch a bit, was our first observations with Chandra showed these huge cavities in the center of the cluster Hydra A. Keep this picture in mind, because what I'm going to show you is this is also the tip of the iceberg. There's a vast complex of holes that go beyond this. And that was sort of the first indication that the black holes could actually do something on a large scale. And we also proposed a way to do this quantitatively so that we could actually measure the energy. So what is the evidence there for feedback in clusters? That's one example. This is probably the most famous example. This is the Perseus cluster data taken not too long after ours by Andy Fabian. And what you can see here, this is an X-ray image. If we were to take a visual image with a telescope, you'd see a giant galaxy sitting here. But here in X-ray, you just see the hot gas. Okay, and you can see that, you know, originally, at least long ago, it was thought that the gas would be smoothly distributed in hydrostatic equilibrium. But you can see there are these big cavities, there are holes, there's a set of cavities here. There's this fine structure, which are weak shocks emanating from the center. All of this is energy that's being dumped into the hot gas. And the total amount of energy in this system is about 10 to the 59 Earth. So I call that a galaxy scale outburst. And all of these cavities are basically suspended within the body of the galaxy. And then we also have these cluster scale outbursts that peak at around 10 to the 62 Earths. And you can see in this system, the cavities are way out here. They're way outside of the body of the galaxy. They're affecting this thing on a cluster scale. Okay. This is just another image because it's a pretty image. This sort of showed us that there's a duty cycle here. So that what's shown here, this is the X-ray image here. This is a radio source at the center. You can see it's a pretty powerful radio source, but it sits here, and these cavities sit out here. And what this showed us is that these things are popping off cavities every few 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 8 years. So there's some periodicity in this thing. That's what we thought then. I'm not convinced they're actually popping off. I think these things may just be on all the time. But you would never know that if you were taking a radio picture. You do.
But I just didn't show it here.
So this is a this what shows what this shows is another deep image of the Hydra A cluster taken with Chandra. This is real data. It's pretty cool. You can see there are these, it's a mosaic. So as this thing orbits the Earth, it has to keep its flaps pointed toward the sun. And so you get this rotation in the focal plane, and you can build up this mosaic. So this is the focal plane rotating around. It's not that ugly, but you can see the X-ray emission coming from this thing sitting in the center. And when you subtract a model from this to get rid of the overall emission, sort of a DC offset, and you smooth it a bit, this is what you see. Okay? And I said keep that picture in mind before, because that earlier thing, our first 10 to the 59 or just find in 2000, that's the guy sitting here. When we got very deep imaging, what you can see is the entire inner 500 kiloparsecs of this thing is like Swiss cheese. Okay? The filling factor is about 10%. So this is filled with these cavities. Okay? And surrounding this, this is a weak shock front. It's weak. It's only a Mach 1.2 or 1.3, but it's so large that it has it's PDV, okay? So it has a huge amount of energy. Yeah.
Oh yes, this is 10 to the 61.
The 10 to the 59 and these two little guys, 10 to the 61 when you add all that in and the shock. Well, the other one is. Well, this is mine too.
So I just want to sure I understand what I'm looking at. All those little dark areas are also mini cavities, basically.
Yes.
And the big ones are giant cavities, yep. And everything dark is basically
everything dark is a hole.
Is a hole. Okay. I just want to be sure I understood what I was looking at.
Yep. These are holes.
This
is an X-ray image. Okay. So this is all about 2 kV.
This is about 7/10 to the 7 degrees Kelvin. It's hot, 300 degrees Kelvin in here. So, yeah.
Stupid, naive question here, just because this is not my briar patch. You've got this Swiss cheese, holes all over the place. And the explanation is going to be that all these holes are caused essentially by this.
Let me go forward. I'm going to give a nice explanation with equations, so everybody will be happy.
So let me ask you something. So you're saying all this graininess is real. It's not like a photon.
No. Well, there is graininess that is noise, but I will show. That is a picture of the 300
megahertz low frequency radio emission. Okay? It fills this thing like a glove. So you can see the energy is coming out. Those initial cavities I showed, that's this image here. This is all 300 megahertz emission. It fills these holes remarkably well. They're real.
The tiny, tiny
ones, I wouldn't vet the farm.
Okay. So there is some photon, like.
There is noise. It's probably not photon noise, but there is noise in there.
Are there any galaxies in the cavities?
There are, yeah.
So it's just there are holes in the gas.
There are holes in the gas, right. So this is a
very dilute plasma, okay? So the densities are 10 to the minus 2 to 10 to the minus 3 atoms per cubic centimeter, okay, at a very high temperature. But it's the pressure is 10 to the minus 10 dynes. So, again, it's low pressure physics for a physicist. But this is over a huge volume. You take that, multiply it by the volume, and the energies are enormous. Yeah, I'll show that in a second. I better get on to that otherwise. So I've been talking numbers. This is how we get the numbers. So what we suggested in our paper in 2000 was, look, if these things are sweeping away the gas, they're displacing the gas, it means that they're light. Okay, they're buoyant. They have to sweep away. If they're going to push it away, they have to do work against the surrounding pressure. Okay, we measure the surrounding pressure exquisitely well. We measure the temperature and density. We know what the pressure is out here. Okay, we can see that there is not an appreciable amount of gas in these things. Okay, so they're light. They're buoyant. They should be rising the way a hot air balloon rises in the atmosphere. So we measure that, and we've also found lots of these things. If these were just transient objects, we wouldn't see many. They just collapse on a sound crossing time. So they're obviously stable. They're stable for at least two crossings of their diameter. And that means their internal pressure has to be very close to the external pressure. The other thing is we don't see strong shocks. If these were strongly overpressured, we'd know it. So it looks like the pressure in the inside is roughly equal to the pressure on the outside. So they're roughly in pressure balance. they're rising up by buoyancy. There may be some dynamical effects there, but simulations and observations have shown that that's probably good to within a factor of two, which is great. To put it in perspective, the uncertainties in this sort of thing before were measured in decades. Now we're quibbling about factors. Okay, this is progress, very quick progress. And so well, the argument is that these things are in pressure balance, so the work done provides one PV of energy, and whatever is filling it provides another couple of PV of energy, depending on what the nature of the gas is that's filling it, what the ratio of specific heats is. So if it's a relativistic plasma, we'll get 4 PV of energy per cavity. If it's just a normal monatomic gas, we'll get 2.5 PV per cavity. So we know how much total energy there is. And this is interesting, because when you observe a quasar, you get the instantaneous power. What we get is both the integrated power of the outburst from the PDV work, and because we get a time scale, we get a buoyancy time scale, we know how long it will take to rise to its position, so that's a time scale, and when they have shocks, we not only get the total energy in the shock, we also get a Mach number, and that tells us how old it is. And they agreed to within a factor of two. Yeah.
The temperature will have to be much lower, because you don't see them in the X-ray. Whatever is filling.
No, much hotter. If it's much lower, you'll see it.
It's the other way around.
It's the other way around.
Okay.
It's just because it's thermal pressure. Okay. So it has to be much hotter. That's right. It could be filled with just a normal hot plasma that is heated during the event, and it would have to be greater than 20 keV for us not to see it. Okay. There are ways of other ways of finding it. So, for example, using SD measurements, we can actually do this, but I'm going to get it. Okay. So basically, that's what you do. You know, that's kind of boring physics, probably. But what makes it great in my field is it's so simple, it's very hard to quibble with. It's really a simple, direct measurement of the total output from a supermassive black hole. And that's the beauty, is the simplicity. And so now what we can do is address this issue of feedback. Can black holes actually stop stars from forming? And is this why galaxies are not all blue and forming stars? And this was a project done by one of my thesis students, basically. Simple thing. It has to conserve energy. At the very minimum, there has to be enough energy in the output of the black hole to offset the radiation losses that would lead to cooling. And that's what's shown here. This is the cavity pressure. This is the power coming out in the cavities, the mean power found using the method I just described. This is the cooling luminosity, or how much radiation has to be offset to prevent star formation. And here is equality between those two, assuming 1 PV of energy per cavity, 4 PVs of energy per cavity, which is our preferred model, and 16 PV of energy per cavity, which some people have argued may be real. And what you can see here is something quite remarkable. What you see is that on average, there's enough energy being pumped out of the black holes to balance cooling. Some of them are a little low. Okay, so these guys look like they have not quite enough, so they're a little bit underpowered. And keep in mind that some of these things are forming stars. There is cold gas in them, so that's consistent with that idea. There are others that are overpowered, like MS07, and it has very little cold gas in the center. But on average, they seem to be able to offset the cooling losses. The other thing that's interesting here is that they seem to know about how much power they need. So these systems up here, which have very high luminosities for cooling, have very powerful cavities. And the systems down here that have low luminosities have fairly weak systems. So somehow what's going on in the inner 10 to the 14th centimeters has been communicated to what's going on the larger scales of 10 to the 23 centimeters, and it seems to know about that. That's what you'd expect from something like a feedback loop. Yeah?
Sorry, this seems... Can we go back to that button real quick? So each data point, each triangle here, is a galaxy cluster somewhere out there that you've observed?
Yes.
And is this all the galaxy clusters that anybody has ever seen, or have you picked ones with particular behavior?
These are galaxy clusters that have these big cavity systems in them. There are about 36 of them or so.
Okay, so there's other ones that do not have big cavities.
That's correct.
And those are all forming stars?
Or? Nope, they tend to lie in systems that are just hot. So there are systems that have very cool centers and have short cooling times, and there are systems that have
much longer cooling times that exceed the current age of that system, they don't seem to show many cavities, or they show a smaller fraction of them, and they have galaxies that aren't forming stars. There are some flies in the ointment. There are some that seem to have very short cooling times and aren't forming stars, and we don't understand those systems, but it could just be a Dewey cycle effect. Okay, basically, the luminosity coming out is pretty constant coming from the X-rays, but the radio source may cycle. And so the reason why we don't see cavities now may be that they've either floated off into the ozone, basically, and we can't see them, or they're on the verge of forming another cavity.
And so the basic mechanism being posited here is that when you have a short cooling time, that cooling time, by some mechanism that you're going to explain, leads to cavities. Which
right.
Yeah.
So the idea, the simple idea is, as the gas cools, it accretes down to the center. Some of it will form stars. Some small trickle of it will fall down onto the black hole. The amount of energy you get out of that is, 10 to the 20 ergs per gram. Okay, the standard amount. That leads to a very big outburst that heats the gas up. That quenches star formation. It holds, staves off accretion for a while. That energy dissipates. Then eventually it cools down again, and the process repeats. That's the simple thing. I actually think it's probably continuous.
That's a little more controversial.
So what's the evidence that for the cycle that I just described? This is the basic evidence. Number one, the cooling time. So this is a plot here of cooling time of the hot gas versus radius in these systems. And what you see is that the cooling time isn't flat. It's not set, okay, at sort of the age of the system up here. What you see is that as you go to the center of the galaxies, or the centers of the clusters, the cooling times drop, okay? And they drop down to about 10 to the 8th years in the center. And the interesting thing is the gas is seen with a short cooling time regardless of the power output. So we can see systems that have, like that system that I showed first that submitted 10 to the 62 ergs. That thing still has a cooling time that's as short as 3 to 5 times 10 to the 8th years, okay? When these things, when this idea was first postulated, what you'd expect naively, let's just say, is that if these things weren't in this kind of a feedback system, matter would fall into the black hole. It would blast the hell out of this thing. It would heat the gas up. The gas would get very hot. It would get less dense. The cooling time would shoot up to basically the dynamical time scale of the system, and it would stay that way for eternity. Well, not eternity, but essentially eternity as far as we're concerned. You don't see that. What you see is, regardless of the power output, the cooling time drops. And that means these things have to be constantly, energy has to be constantly pumped in. Otherwise, this will undergo runaway cooling, a cooling catastrophe, and these things will turn into galaxies that look like they did back in the Stone Ages. The second point is what I've made here. I've already made this point. The galaxies, the clusters seem to know about what's going on in the black hole. And the third one is a related quantity. This is just entropy. It's a little bit more technical, and I'm running out of time. But basically, in a system that did not have feedback or energy coming out of the black hole, you expect a power law entropy profile. What we observe in these systems is that the entropy hits a floor. It floors out in the center, and that's an indication that the gas is being heated by the black hole. So that is, in a nutshell, the observational evidence that feedback controls galaxy formation. Now, these concepts have run amok in the theoretical literature, and it's been expanded now to describe galaxy formation all over the place. Most of these models are unrealistic, in my opinion, but nevertheless, this is the fundamental basis for it. There is good reason to think that that feedback is important, and many people now think that this is the governing mechanism that forms galaxies, makes galaxies as they are. And I'm starting to run out of time. There's other evidence for it. This was a neat effect that my student found in his thesis, which is that the star formation rates in this thing are tightly tuned to the cooling time of the central gas. So there is good evidence. I'll just stop with that and move on to my final 10 minutes. I knew I'd run out of time. So this is the picture. Basically, here's jet power on this axis. This is a cartoon picture, X-ray cooling. This is the 4PV line. And basically what we see, I didn't show this data. If you look at normal ellipticals in the nearby universe, all of them seem to have jet power that exceeds the cooling time of the gas or the cooling power in their halos, essentially all of them. And these are all the ones that are old, red, and dead, okay, as the sort of colloquial parlance in the field of galaxy formation. And when you get into these CD clusters that I've been showing, they're struggling to stave off cooling. And so we see systems that are both blue and forming stars, and we see systems that are red and dead. And there is some evidence to suggest that where they lie in this just depends on the power output coming from the AGN. Okay, so that's it in a nutshell. And this is again, I won't discuss this. This is some modeling that was done by Richard Bauer, who spoke several weeks ago, so you may have seen that. Basically, this notion has now been applied to models for galaxy formation, and they argue that you can take this physics, stick it in, and explain why galaxies are red and dead, and they're not burgeoning today. So that's it for the galaxy formation side. There are a lot of other things that we can learn. So, for example, jet energetics, one of the questions that has been around for a long time is, you know, what are these things? So this is Cygnus A, which is, this is synchrotron emission. This is a bright knot in the center of a galaxy. We think there's a big black hole there. In fact, it's been measured at several 10 to the 8 solar masses. What is this stuff that's being ejected in these narrow streams from supermassive black holes? And again, we can learn that from these cavities. This is another a plot of cavity power shown here, but this is synchrotron radiation here. And this sort of explains a couple of things. Number one, it explains why this problem, this cooling problem, which has been around for 30 years, wasn't solved 30 years ago. And the reason is we just didn't know how much power was coming out. Basically, theory suggested that the amount of energy, the total mechanical energy you'd get out of a jet is about 10 times more than what you see in synchrotron power. Okay, and that's not enough to offset these cooling rates. What we find when we plot this up is that we have systems here. So this is a system that's 10 to the 45 ergs per second in cavity power. And you go over to here. Here's this object. That's a quasar in an astronomer's parlance. You come down here. Its radio power is only something like 10 to the 42. So basically, the reason why this problem wasn't solved is we just had no idea how powerful these things are. Monsters sitting in the centers of galaxy clusters, but if you take pictures of them in the normal wave bands, you'd never know that much power was coming out. And what this shows is that you can get systems that have ratios of mechanical energy to luminous energy coming out that are factors of thousands over what you'd expect. And that means that something different is happening near the black hole. Okay, something is creating these things that's very different from what's going on in a quasar. And the current idea is it's related to the structure of the disk. But it's not clear that that's correct. The other thing that's great about this in a practical sense is we have reduced the scatter sum, and we can now use this when we can peer to. We can only see these X-ray cavities in relatively nearby systems, but if we want to study the formation of structure on large scales, we can now relate the synchrotron power to how much true power is coming out, and we can start exploring the power output in systems all over the universe. That's sort of a technical point. So what do I want to finish up with? That's sort of the stuff that's been around for a little bit. I just have 7 minutes. So I won't even get through all of this stuff. So I'll just talk about the bottom thing, which is ultramassive black holes. So I mentioned earlier this picture. I went through this quite a bit. This is a very powerful system. And what I'm interested in now is using how much power is coming out on these large scales, 10 to the 23 centimeters, figuring out what's going on in the small scales. And one thing that has come up, I mentioned this issue with cold gas in these systems. The traditional way of powering an AGN is to take cold gas and drop it in. And so you'd expect, since we know how much total power output is coming out, you can correlate that with the mass of molecular gas in the center, and you'd expect that the power output would correlate with the amount of mass available to fuel the system, and it turns out it's completely unrelated to it. The total amount of mass, this shows the gas mass on this axis versus jet power. This is MSO735. That's got an upper limit of a few 10 to the 9. There are other systems that have two orders of magnitude more gas in them and have likewise two orders of magnitude smaller jet powers. So there's some disconnect here. Somehow the jet power doesn't seem to know about how much gas is there, and I would argue that it's probably because most of that gas is getting consumed by stars. But whatever it is, whatever is getting the mass down to the black hole and making it shine, it doesn't seem to know about how much gas is there. And in fact, there are several of these systems that are extraordinarily powerful that just don't seem to have much gas in them, which is pretty weird. Yeah. It could be, yes, it could be, but it does. I don't think that'll work for all of them. The extreme guys are the ones that tell you something about what's actually going on. And in those systems, it still requires, you know, the biggest problem that you have is that the gas has to shed its angular momentum. And that's a pretty inefficient process. And there are systems here where literally the gas has to basically say, I'm going to the black hole, and it has to make a beeline for it. And even though it's getting denser as it goes in, none of it is going to form stars. That's pretty weird. Okay, so there is another way to do this. One possibility is that these things are fed by Bondi accretion. They're in a big hot atmosphere, so maybe they're just pulling in the hot gas. The problem there is, in order to get these extreme jet powers, it requires gas densities that are much higher than we observe, or it implies that you have to have gas of black hole masses, since the Bondi accretion rate square scales with the black hole mass. You have to get some, the accretion rate scales with the square, actually. You have to get something that's of order 10 to the 11 solar masses to do it, and I'm not going to stand up here and argue for that. The other possibility is these things are powered by spin. And the idea with the spin, as I mentioned before, is that you have a magnetic pressure in the surrounding the black hole that's pinned to a disk, okay? And the power output depends on the square of the black hole mass and the spin parameter. Okay, I don't have time to go into it because it's late. The appeal of this is that there's probably a way to couple this to the surrounding gas. If this thing is powered by spin, then it turns out that the magnetic pressure correlates with the accretion rate falling into the center. And that's how you could couple spin to a feedback loop. The problem is you still need a lot of accretion in order to make this work using standard models. Okay, so the solution then could be that the black holes are very big. Is there evidence for big black holes? And this is, I'm really going to finish, okay? So this is sort of what I'm really interested in right now. This is the best evidence we have right now for the existence of an ultramassive black hole, as they've come to be called. And it's, you know, it's pretty, you know, if taken at face value, it looks pretty boring, okay? I got this HST image, and the only thing I could find, I had a student working on it, and I had to sort of go into his office every day and say, I know what you're finding is really boring, but it's really cool because it's boring. And I think he finally got it, right? So it looks completely normal. This is a profile. This is the surface brightness profile in the center, and this is radius. And you see this is what they call an art of the quarter law. It goes back to this guy named de Vaucouleurs, lived a long time ago. And then instead of going up the way you expect a normal galaxy to go and peaking at the center, and that's a natural consequence of dissipation, you get this big flat core. And it's got a core radius that it turns out is the biggest core radius ever observed. So why is that interesting? It's 3.8 kiloparsecs in size. Okay, and core radii are typically less than a kiloparsec, in most cases typically much less. And some recent work that I won't show has come out, which argues that the size of the core radius correlates to the size of the black hole. And it's a real simple idea. Galaxies aren't formed with cores. They're actually formed with cusps. So you go to lower mass galaxies, they have very cuspy things. They have bright nuclei. And if you merge, if you form big galaxies by merging them, as, you know, as the pundits tell us they do, all you'll get is a big bright galaxy with a big bright core. Well, you don't get that. What you get, as you notice, is these things get more massive, they get fainter in the center. It's a little bit weird. And the idea is that it's post-processing. The idea is that not only do the galaxies merge, but the black holes have to merge. And in order to make the black holes merge, they need to throw away their angular momentum. And the way they do that is by two-body interactions, n-body interactions, with stars. And so they fling out their own mass in stars in order to settle down into the center. That's a little bit simplified, but basically that's the upshot. And so the idea is that you measure, this is the wonky part, the excess light there, and you multiply it up by what you think the mass-to-light ratio is, and out pops the black hole mass. And it's like, in this case, the light deficit is 2 times 10 to the 10 solar luminosities, and you multiply it through by a reasonable mass-to-light ratio, and you get a potential black hole mass of 6 times 10 to the 10 solar masses. Now, this is really one of these crazy moments, okay, but it turns out that John Cormody and some others, is a pretty good guy, he's the sort of pro in this area, has correlated this, I may have a plot slide of it, but I'm not going to show it, has correlated this excess light with nearby galaxies with measured black hole masses, and he gets this beautiful correlation. I think he overplays it. I don't think it's that good in reality, but there's a correlation there, so this is not completely crazy. But the problem is, how do you know what the original light profile is? Well, you don't, okay? But in this case, it turns out that if there's a mass that's that big there, its gravitational radius of influence will be about half an arc second. And guess what? HST can do more than 10 times better than that. And so I have a proposal rolling right now. If there's anybody on the tack here, I doubt it, to try to measure it. And it should be measurable easily because even though this is more or less a parched galaxy, it does have ionized gas in it. So this is an image of the galaxy. This is the ionized gas. There's not a lot by mass there. But the great thing about it is ionized gas gets caught up in the potential, and we can use this. It's bright, and we can use it to measure the mass of the black hole. So I'm hoping that maybe in a year I'll be able to tell you that there's an ultramassive black hole there, or at least I'll be able to tell you how much it's diverting itself from the Megorian relation. And again, I was going to talk about, I think spin is another possibility here, but there are serious theoretical issues with spin, which I think are very interesting because it implies maybe there's a mechanism to tap spin without a large accretion rate. And I'll finish with just saying these are some of the theoretical issues that are outstanding for those of you who might be interested. Maybe there's a Psi student or two in the audience that might want to work on this. And I'll stop there. Thanks a lot for listening.
Okay, thank you very, very much. So questions first, the students? Good questions. No?
That's either good or bad.
Real physics, real. Okay. Latham is...
So how big is the magnetic field? How far out is the magnetic field associated with such a big black hole supposed to extend? So, I mean, in other words, when you're saying it's weird to feed so much mass that it's somehow directed towards the center of the cluster, if you could feed it in along the field lines, along magnetic field lines at all point with the black hole, that alleviate it? Do those extend out far enough that that will alleviate it?
Well, the plasma is magnetized, but it's most likely, the topology of the magnetic field is not known, but it's most likely pre-tangled. And, I mean, I'm not exactly sure what you're arguing, but basically...
it's just that if it was pinned to a field line, all the field lines point to the black hole and all the...
Well, that's a very interesting. I don't see how you could keep the field lines pointed into the black hole because it's sitting in an atmosphere which is sloshing around at hundreds of kilometers a second. So,
or just the fact that the magnetic field is a lot stronger near the black hole, that's true. And that says the field line.
Near the black hole, that may be true. Actually, in order to make the mechanism work, you mean just to get the accretion in?
Just to get enough material in very close.
No, I hadn't really.
Maybe black hole is a magnetic monopole, like everything is monopole.
I mean, I think the gas would still.
It wouldn't have to all be the same polarity.
That's an interesting idea. I hadn't actually thought about that.
Yeah, Joe?
So, maybe I drifted off at the wrong moment. But you were saying at the beginning the gas that we could see is blue in that slide we took 10 minutes sort of interrogating you about. You said it was a little bit hotter than it should be. And then you said this mechanism might be able to explain this slight anomaly in the temperature. So, right. did you go over that?
I didn't talk about it in detail, but yeah, there's basically this this problem in galaxy clusters, which is primarily for lower mass systems, where the temperature, the relationship between mass and temperature seems to show a break. And what it shows is what's known as this preheating problem. That is, it seems like the gas that's fallen into these clusters to make them grow came in with excess entropy. And it may have come in with excess entropy, or it may have been introduced later, but it's thought that energy was boosted by, the detritus from galaxy formation, which is primarily most of the energy is in the building. You don't get a black hole for free, basically. If you build a black hole, you have to release binding energy, and it has to go somewhere. And it probably ends up in this hot gas. But I didn't discuss that in detail. I think John.
Unfortunately, I just missed the first part of the talk. Large object collapses gravitationally, freezes. You look at it from a coordinate type. So, how and when can we determine observation that missile event horizon has GEO?
Well, there are people that are looking in the radio. I don't know a lot about that, but there are people that argue that just due to the light bending effects and with some knowledge of what the structure is around the black hole, that the you'll get effects that can be identified as an event horizon, basically at low frequencies in the radio. And I think that's where most of the thrust is right now, actually looking in the Milky Way, but also in M87, which is a good candidate. That's the idea. But until, right now, this is all pretty speculative. We don't know that they exist, so.
So this is a mechanism for getting more energy into gas. So into the gas for a given cluster, right? So what is the bottom line, that if you measured the temperature in a cluster, that you would infer a different mass? You would get a new mass to temperature relationship. Is that the idea?
The idea is, in principle, yes. So if you assume that these things are self-similar, okay, and this was stuff done by Kaiser and others in the late 80s, you assume that these things have very similar profiles, and they basically have power law relationships between their temperature and their mass and luminosity and so on. And it turns out that they deviate from these self-similar relations, which only have gravity in them. And they deviate in such a way that there seems to be excess energy for their temperatures. And the ideas that have been floated to explain this are that either the gas comes in preheated,
right,
or that it's heated in situ somehow. So that's basically the idea.
So but if you were to use this for cosmology and cluster counts at a given mass, if you were right, would that mean that the cluster counts at high mass would go down or up?
Cluster counts, let's see. So what happens is that if you add energy, the cluster expands, and in principle, the luminosity should drop. And so you would think that you would see fewer. That's what the predictions are. Predictions seem to be kind of wrong, though, because there are long-time scale effects and short-time scale effects. On the long-time scale, that's probably what should happen. But when you, for example, compare things like MSO7 that just got blasted with this big outburst, it turns out that its luminosity is higher than you would expect. Predictions show, predictions suggest that it should be lower than you expect. And so in that case, what happens, the luminosity is what matters, because that's usually how you detect them. You're probably going to detect more clusters that have been pinged by these things than you would otherwise expect. So I think the theory and the observation are a little bit in conflict there. The theory doesn't include a lot of the messy physics that's going on.
And just, sorry, can I ask one more?
Yeah.
So for the recent thing with the South Pole telescope, seeing relatively too few clusters, would that be explained by this long-term thing?
I think a lot of that was just cosmology, right?
Well, I mean,
because originally they were predicting huge numbers, and then WMAP came out, and the numbers predictions went down. And then, but why are they not? I'm not sure. I mean, Mayesh has ideas about that. Maybe.
I think AGN is good to do it exactly. If you have extra power, it's going to decrease the luminosity, and you won't do that.
So it'd be the same story.
So it'd be the same. Well, there are a couple of stories. One is that it just drives mass out.
Okay.
And that's been predicted. But again, I'm giving a talk next week in Utah, and I'm going to show that those predictions don't match. But actually, it turns out you see the opposite effect. So, I don't know the answer. I mean, maybe it's AGN, but I don't want to be too bandwagon. Could be right. Certainly is appealing. It's very nice when you have an object that you can dump mass in, dial it up to 10% or whatever of MC squared. You can do anything. But this shows that you do it.
So Fermi has the last question. I have the last question, which is a very broad thermodynamic question. So the weirdest thing about all the stuff in this, all this very energetic stuff in the sky, is that the universe is 14 billion years old and it doesn't look mobile close to equilibrium. It doesn't look, there are people who write papers about why is the universe not in equilibrium, wasn't equilibrium at the, just after inflation or whatever. Why is it not equilibrium? So is the one line answer that the system is, systems are far from equilibrium because gravitationally bound systems have negative specific heat, and big black hole at the center of the galaxy is the prime example of a system with negative specific heat, something that its environment is out of equilibrium?
That's that's a very interesting suggestion. I mean, I'm not going to, I don't know the answer to it, but that's, they play a role. You can't neglect them in terms of the power activity system that they dominate.
Well,
Greg, well, wonderful talk. Thank you very much.